wisdom is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, November 3rd, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Asking the right questions after the Richmond gang rape, understanding why American conservatives love Ayn Rand, and Empire Notes on Clinton and Pakistan. Plus, the L.A. mayor picks Deputy Police Chief Charlie Beck to lead the LAPD.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa will be formally announcing his choice of LAPD chief this morning. The three finalists who made it to the last round of interviews included LAPD Deputy Chief Charlie Beck, Assistant Chief Jim McDonnell, and Deputy Chief Michael Moore. This morning's LA Times blog reported just minutes ago that the mayor has tapped Deputy Police Chief Charlie Beck. Beck will replace William Bratton, who came in as an outsider to the city 7 years ago from the East Coast. Bratton recently resigned to take a high-paying job with a private international security firm. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office just announced that it would not prosecute any of the LAPD's officers involved in the violent clashes of the 2007 Immigration May Day March in MacArthur Park. The move comes as a surprise, given that Chief Bratton himself took a strong position by disciplining several officers involved, and the LA City Council agreed to pay nearly $13 million to the plaintiffs. Joining me this morning is Carol Sobel. She is the National Lawyers Guild attorney for the May Day plaintiffs. Welcome to Uprising, Carol.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, before we talk about the MacArthur Park issue, what do you make of Villaraigosa's choice? I know it's just been announced this morning, but do you have any thoughts on Charlie Beck?
I think it's the right choice. I've worked a lot with Beck over the last 10 years. I think that he is the best person to lead this department at this point. And, you know, he remains a police officer. We disagree about things. But he is one of the most accessible people in that department, and I think has demonstrated over the last couple of years that he's really willing to consider alternatives. It's not the LAPD's way or no way. So I'm really hopeful that he's going to be a healer. The thing that marks Charlie Beck apart from a lot of other people in that department is what I would describe as the lack of arrogance and the lack of swagger, which is always a problem with police chiefs. He's just a down-to-earth person. As I said, he remains the police chief, and I have no illusions about that. But I think he's going to be good for this city.
Well, he's been around for 32 years with the LAPD. How does he compare to Bratton?
Well, he's a very different person than Bratton. Bratton is, you know, somebody who is
brash.
Yeah, brash. A lot more ego. Bratton views himself as a person who goes around from city to city, becoming the chief in different places. That's not Charlie Beck. Charlie Beck is somebody who grew up in the LAPD. His father was a deputy chief. He's lived his whole life. Two of his kids are LAPD officers. And he's just not a brash person at all. Although I will tell you, the way I met him was in a screaming match between us over Skid Row when he became the new captain there. And it took a while, but I'd like to think our relationship is at the point now where we can have reasoned discussions about how to address an issue where the police have used a hammer and we think something, you know, they should have used a glove.
Hmm. And so what is his relationship, not only with people like yourself, but how well is he known within the local activist community, with civil rights advocates, with advocates for the homeless and advocates for, you know, doing something about gang violence with constructive solutions rather than police violence?
Well, he's very well known in all of those areas. I had the opportunity to work on the last Rampart report. I do a lot of work on Skid Row, as people know. And when I meet with the community activists, they all say the same thing. Beck may not agree with you in the end, but he's fair, and he'll listen to you. He has been the fix-it person in this department since Bratton got here. He was assigned to Rampart after as soon as Bratton got here and signed to clean up the Rampart and create a new environment there where the officers had a different notion about their relationship with the community. He was assigned to South L.A. where he dealt a lot with the gang intervention stuff and is still involved in those issues. And then, of course, you know, he was assigned to Detective Bureau to clean up the mess there where rape kits weren't being process where just a lot of problems were going on in terms of how crimes were investigated. He's always worked, he's frequently worked the communities of color in this city, and, you know, I've never heard anyone say anything but what I've just said to you about his being accessible, his being reasonable, and his being somebody who is willing to take a different approach.
Well, maybe he'd be willing to come on our program to talk a little bit about how he plans to police. Let's talk, Carol, about MacArthur Park 2 years ago. The media call it the May Day Melee, where police, LAPD police officers, seemingly without provocation, attacked peaceful protesters as well as members of the press. You've been defending several of the people involved, and the city council agreed to pay a lot of money to the plaintiffs, and yet we just heard that the DA's office is not going to prosecute any officers. What's going on there?
Well, I think the city's approach to this has been somewhat schizophrenic. Hmm. On the one hand, you know, you have Bratton and Mayor Villaraigosa and other city officials who come out and apologize and who say it was our fault. The police department, in a unique response, I've never seen this before in the country, here or anywhere else, issued a report in which they said it was our fault. We, you know, yeah, there were a few people who might have thrown things at the police, but overall, it was our fault. And specifically said, even if there was a basis to go into the southern part of the park, and for your listeners, people should know this MacArthur Park is a huge piece mm-hmm. of land separated by an 8-lane road. Wilshire Boulevard cuts right through the middle of it. So the police department said, even if there was a reason for police to respond to the people in the southern part of the park, there was no justification for the northern part of the park. That's where the press was. That's where a lot of families were. And the reason I point that out is because the district attorney's report says that the press unwittingly put itself into the mix of the demonstrators. That's not true. That's just not true, and the police department doesn't say that. So on the one hand in this case, you've got Chief Bratton and the mayor saying it was our fault. You've got an internal affairs investigation that I think was just more of a justification for what the police did and basically tried to shift the blame to the demonstrators. And then you've got the district attorney who says, well, you know, you can't really tell who did things. I can tell you, having seen the videos, 200 hours of videos over about May Day, you can easily tell 3 or 4 officers who repeatedly beat people.
And Carol, do you think that this this approach, what the DA's office has decided to really not do, is part of that sort of unspoken rule that police officers never get prosecuted, and if they do get prosecuted, they never get convicted, that this is, you know, that police officers can never commit crimes? I mean, sure, they can be disciplined, but they cannot be prosecuted or convicted of crimes.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and in part because the district attorney needs those police officers as witnesses mm-hmm. in other cases against ordinary people and non-police people. And so there is this unspoken rule, sometimes even a spoken rule, that creates a conflict for them. They can't really do the prosecution, which is why in a situation like this, there should have been an outside prosecutor looking at this. It should have been somebody who doesn't depend upon officers from the Los Angeles Police Department to make their other cases.
Well, Carol, finally, let's talk about Charlie Beck again, who is to lead the LAPD, replacing Chief Bratton. On the issue of immigration in particular, since we're looking at what happened on May Day 2007, where does he stand? And, you know, do you think that sort of future demonstrations or marches, whether they're immigration related or not, may have a different reaction or response from the LAPD?
I think there'll be a very different response. I know that the leadership in the LAPD is continuing to create different training materials and different policies. And we've really seen a real change in a lot of areas of the city and how the police respond to demonstrations. And I'll tell you, I do these cases around the country. When the LAPD is doing it right, they are the best in the country. But the problem is getting, and it's a problem with all the reform across the board, whether it's how they respond to violence or alleged violence in community of color, how they respond to immigrants, whatever it is, it's important to have that drilled down into the DNA of the LAPD. That's the tough stuff. It's not hard to get the people at the top to take a different approach. It's hard to get the officers in the street. And that's the challenge for Charlie Beck or anybody else.
And I'm assuming that Charlie Beck will continue Chief Bratton's position on the federal law that was recently renewed, 287G, that would allow for city police departments to also take the same function as immigration enforcement. Bratton, just a few days before his last day, penned an op-ed in the LA Times basically saying it's called the LAPD Fights Crime, Not Illegal Immigration.
I don't know what Charlie Beck's position would be on mm-hmm. that. I think, Beck is not going to pursue the immigration issues just to pursue the immigration issues. That I'm relatively confident of, just knowing who he is and what the focus is. And I think, you know, the effort is going to be on continuing reforms to the extent that, you know, they need to be continued, which is certainly true. One thing we know is, you know, you can demonstrate that you are following the reforms one day and fall back the next day. And May Day is the best example.
Right. Well, Carol Sobel, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Carol Sobel is the National Lawyers Guild attorney for the May Day plaintiffs, May Day 2007, where many demonstrators who were peacefully demonstrating for immigration reform were attacked by the LAPD, as well as many members of the press. The DA's office has, in a surprise move, decided not to prosecute any LAPD officers. And, of course, the mayor is going to be formally announcing his choice of the LAPD Deputy Chief Charlie Beck to lead the LAPD this morning. That's breaking news just this morning. We're going to take a listen to today's subversive historian. And when we come back, we'll find out why conservatives find a hero in the writer Ayn Rand. We'll also hear this week's Empire Notes after that on Clinton and her recent trip to Pakistan. Finally, at the end of the hour, Ron Astor will join us in studio asking the right questions after the brutal Richmond High gang rape. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on November 3rd, 1793, French playwright and feminist Olympe de Gouges was sent to the scaffold to meet her death. As women were central to the drama of the French Revolution, Gouges emerged in the years that followed as a voice that articulated the shortcomings of the sweeping changes in society. Perhaps her best-known polemic, Declaration of the Rights of Women, was penned in 1791 and argued passionately for the equality of the sexes. Gouges, who also advocated advocated for the abolition of slavery in France's colonies, had other democratic impulses that rattled her detractors. She faced a guillotine for another tome that suggested form of governance, whether it be Republican, Federalist, or constitutional monarchy, be put before the people via plebiscite. Seated in power, Maximilien Robespierre wanted Goget beheaded, as her mind carried many, much too many dangerous thoughts. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
I'm Ian Masters, host of The Daily Briefing, heard Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KPFK in Los Angeles. Why should we appear brain dead when there are so many smart people in America? Just as the president gets a daily briefing from the best and brightest that is objective and free of ideology, I want you, the audience, to listen in on what the smartest and best-informed people in the world, who are closest to the scene, have to say about what is going on in the news. Join me for the daily briefing Monday through Thursdays at 5 p.m.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A popular theme at conservative tea parties and rallies this year has been the writer Ayn Rand. Placards reading, "Where is John Galt?" Ayn Rand was right, and Atlas Shrugs invoke the philosophy of a woman whose books published half a century ago are selling more strongly than ever during this recession. Aliza Rosenbaum was born during the death throes of Tsarist Russia and grew up during the Bolshevik regime. Her family fled to the U.S. when she was 21, where she changed her name to Ayn Rand. She arrived in Hollywood and began writing stories that reflected her belief systems based in libertarian capitalism and self-interest. Her novels featured larger-than-life characters with superiority complexes who resolutely resisted government interference in their wealth and entitlements. Now, two new biographies of the Russian-American writer, Goddess of the Market by Jennifer Burns and Ayn Rand and the World She Made by Anne Heller, attempt to understand her thinking and philosophy. But my guest, Johan Hari, claims that the real question is why Ayn Rand has such broad appeal among American conservatives. Today, many conservatives tout Ayn Rand's books as sacred texts that predicted the economic crisis and offer a way out. Some have even blogged about, quote, going John Galt as an individualistic solution of opting out of the economy to end the crisis. Johan Hari is a journalist and writer for The Independent of London, winner of the George Orwell Award and Amnesty International Newspaper Journalist of the Year in 2007. He recently wrote an article on Slate.com about Ayn Rand, and I spoke to him earlier this morning. Before we get into the reasons why exactly American conservatives, you think, are so into Ayn Rand, what do you think it was about her own background that led her to write the kinds of things she wrote, to have the kind of philosophy that she had?
You know, I don't find it hard to understand why Ayn Rand had this very extreme reaction to the very extreme ideology of Bolshevism, which was one of the worst tyrannies of the 20th century. What I find odd is that people who, without that background, would take that madness, that traumatized madness, and think it was a sensible political philosophy. Ayn Rand was born in 1905 in St. Petersburg in a liberal Jewish family. Her father was a self-made Jewish pharmacist. Her mother was a kind of aristocrat, basically. And they were growing up in a place where anti-Semitism was rising very fast, and particularly against self-made entrepreneurs like Ayn Rand's father. So there was this kind of rise of revolutionary violence. And then, of course, when the 1917 revolution happened, her father's pharmacy, which he spent a long time building up, was seized, as they put it, in the name of the people. So this girl, who'd grown up surrounded by nannies and servants, was suddenly plunged into this very frightening poverty. Everything she'd ever had was taken away. And, you know, they really thought they were going to die. And there were, you know, 5 million people were dying of starvation all around them. They were going hungry. So I can understand how Ayn Rand made the terrible mistake of taking the communists at their word. When the communists claimed to speak for the people, she thought, yeah, that's what the people want. That's what the people believe. This is what will happen if the people have their say. So when she escapes to America, leaving her family behind, she begins to expound this philosophy that is profoundly against what she considered the people. She basically turned Bolshevism on its head, where Bolsheviks said that the majority of people were good, but there was a parasitic overclass, a kind of evil parasitic overclass that had to be destroyed. She said there's an overclass who are great and virtuous and wonderful, and then there's this parasitic underclass who are feeding on us, and they need to be really quite viciously suppressed. So she really did go crazy. And when she arrived in America, there was a serial killer called William Hickman, who a really horrific guy who kidnapped a 12-year-old girl called Marion Parker from Virginia High School, raped her, dismembered her body, sent in mockingly to the police. She wrote these huge praises of stretches of praise for him. She said, these are the quotes, "He represents the amazing picture of a man with no regard whatsoever for what a society holds sacred and with a consciousness all his own. He is a man who really stands alone in action and soul. Other people don't exist for him, and he doesn't see why they should." And she goes on and on, and she says she only has one regret about this guy. A strong man can eventually trample society under its feet, but that boy Hickman was not strong enough. And she went on all through her life, all her novels, about praising supermen, that was the word she used, who assert their dominance over what she calls the lice of ordinary people.
So it's amazing to see that so many years later, what, 50 years after she published some of her most well-known books, they are still quite popular today. What exactly do you think it is that resonates with American conservatives in particular? We didn't have that specter of Bolshevism that perhaps was the root of Ayn Rand's, philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. You can understand why someone with her background had such an extreme reaction. I obviously don't condone it. I understand why it happened. I cannot understand why someone like Rush Limbaugh, who grew up in wealth, has never been threatened by anyone, has this reaction. It's very, very odd. But I think it's useful to know that they admire these people, because I think it's incredibly revealing. This is the person who's admired. Alan Greenspan was her close friend when he was sworn into the Council of Economic Advisers by Gerald Ford in 1974. She was there in the Oval Office. She was the person he chose as a witness. This is a woman who described the American people. These were the words she used: savages, refuse, inanimate objects, lice, imitations of human beings. Indeed, in one of her books, a striker, someone goes on strike and deliberately causes a train crash. He's going on strike against the fact that the American people have voted for someone who wants slightly higher taxes.
So this is a rich person going on strike.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's a Randian person. He murders a huge number of people, and she explicitly praises him and describes how the Americans on the train deserve to die. And it's useful to know that obviously this is an extreme and caricatured version, but anyone who can read Ayn Rand and feel a sense of admiration is, on a very basic level, not a Democrat. She explicitly did not believe human beings were equal. In fact, she was quite explicit. She said that there should be a democracy of superiors, that the supermen should have a vote, the people like her, but not the lice, the disgusting people, the people like you and me, presumably, who believe in slightly higher taxes on rich people and so on. And in a way, I think that's revealing, because actually, that's what we've got now. You know, the healthcare crisis has shown the rich have the real power. The vote that matters is expressed with a checkbook and a lobbyist. You'll get to vote for the people who the superiors have pre-approved, but you don't get to vote for anyone else. And I think it's kind of useful, if a bit daunting, to know that there's actually a section of the American right that doesn't see that as a problem to be corrected, but sees that as the morally correct situation. I think everyone should read Ayn Rand, because it really gives you an X-ray of the subconscious, of the kind of Rush Limbaugh right, of how they view ordinary people. You know, they're very, at times they adopt the language of Main Street, but really these are people who believe that only the rich are fully human. And people who, and this is, Ayn Rand is very, very clear about that. She literally describes the people who aren't rich as subhuman. And so, of course, you can see why they have this approach to healthcare, for example, if you look at it that way. Well, if you're not, in their terms, smart enough to get your own healthcare, well, why should we care if you die? In Atlas Shrugged, her fantasy about a dystopian society where taxes have gone up, so all the rich people go on strike and suddenly the society collapses. She describes with glee how people are dying in the streets, you know, because it's their own fault because they were stupid and they wanted taxes.
Hmm. I'm speaking with British journalist Johan Hari about his piece that he just wrote on Ayn Rand, the conservative icon. Johan, I want to play for you an excerpt of Glenn Beck's show interviewing somebody, just as an illustration, interviewing somebody from the Ayn Rand Institute and specifically talking about Atlas Shrugged.
I mean, are you looking at Atlas Shrugged now and saying, she told you? How many years ago? Well, it was in the 50s, wasn't it?
This is 51 years ago, Glenn. Published in 1957, and absolutely, she told us so. The economic catastrophe that we're witnessing now parallels very much the catastrophe in the book. The difference is, in the book, the really productive individuals in society are disappearing. So we can't take stuff away from them to redistribute to everybody else anymore. Unfortunately, all the productive people are still sticking around today. So they're going to get taxed even more. They're going to get regulated even more. They're going to get controlled even more.
And that is an excerpt from the Glenn Beck show on
Fox News. You know
what's
funny about that? It's such an extraordinary inversion of the truth. Ayn Rand said that if the rich were left alone, if we got rid of all the restraints on them, they would demonstrate how a perfect society worked. Alan Greenspan, her disciple, helped to pilot that into law. He got rid of all the rules and all the restraints and all the regulations on rich people. And instead of creating a perfect society, they brought the whole roof down on us. And instead of us being the parasites, they came begging to us. Without us, without the ordinary life who Ayn Rand had contempt for, they would be, the whole system would have collapsed. The economic philosophy of Ayn Rand could not have been proven more wrong. But, you know, it's the mentality of the ideologue that every disaster is proof that you're right. You know, you look at the Bolsheviks, who Ayn Rand thought she hated and resembled so closely. Every famine was proof that they just didn't try hard enough in collectivizing everything. And in the same way, every catastrophe caused by deregulation is just proof we didn't deregulate enough to Ayn Randians. It's extraordinary. It's kind of interesting as a study, as a kind of psychological study of delusion. And I think that's what Ayn Rand is. Ayn Rand is a fascinating psychological portrait. These two new biographies of her, both of which are very good, are really interesting studies of psychology, but as studies of political philosophy, my God, they're gibberish.
And what's really interesting here in the United States is that it's very likely that the majority of those who go out and buy her books and read them are not necessarily wealthy folks.
It's incredible. You know, it's worth bearing in mind the vast majority of Americans reject this as crazy, and even the defenders of Ayn Rand, when they find her, you know, I'd be very surprised if even Rush Limbaugh was to defend the fact that she lauded a guy who raped and chopped to pieces a 12-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't want to go too far. Most Americans are good and decent and reject this stuff, and they're being screwed over by this philosophy. But it's true that what's incredible is the people who were buying her books, who admire her. Now, there are some billionaires who admire her, like a disgusting fool Ted Turner or Donald Trump. But equally, there are lots of people who are just being horribly screwed over. I mean, I remember being at the Republican National Convention, sitting next to this absolutely lovely woman from Kansas who worked in Walmart, and her cheering George Bush, and me saying to her, well, you do realize that, you know, he's dismantled your economic protections, he's, you know, you're less likely to get health care. And she said, no, that's not the case. That's not the case. He's looking out for people like me. And there's a kind of tragic false consciousness to it, which doesn't make me angry with the people who are feeling it. It makes me feel desperately sad. You know, when a lot of people thought it was funny when, you know, whenever it was about a month ago, one of these guys violently protesting against the healthcare reform at a town hall got injured by a police officer and started complaining he didn't have any healthcare insurance. And, you know, it's partly funny, but partly it just makes me want to cry.
Yeah.
There's nothing sadder than when people oppose their own interests to protect the people who are screwing them over. And Ayn Rand is, again, an absolute symbol of that. And, you know, I think it's something very revealing. When Ayn Rand died, she died alone in her apartment. She'd driven everyone away by bullying them and intimidating them and being vile to them and mocking them. She died alone, and the only person with her was a nurse who was paid to be there. And if you had Ayn Rand's philosophy, if you believed that the only interaction worth having is one where you pay, that's a great death. She won. Did even Ayn Rand think that in the end, as she was lying there? I doubt it.
My guest is Johan Hari, speaking to us from Britain. He has written an article on Slate.com called How Ayn Rand Became an American Icon. How would you describe her philosophy? I mean, her followers have coined the term objectivism to describe her philosophy, but would you say she was essentially a conservative libertarian?
No, I think that's actually unfair. I have very little sympathy for conservative libertarianism, but I actually think it's unfair to conservative libertarians to call her that. I think she believed in a kind of Nietzschean overclass. She believed that human beings were not equal. She was very clear about that. And that there are kind of overlords who have real rights, and then there's the rest of us who are lice and refuse and barely human and so on. So I think she was a very specific strain, a very strange kind of European Superman-style philosophy, which is perfectly summarized in the title of one of her books, The Virtue of Selfishness. Mm-hmm. She said the only virtue was selfishness, that you should only ever act in your self-interest. She said if you see a drowning person, it's immoral to go and rescue them if there is any risk to yourself. In fact, the Ayn Rand Institute, the day after the 2004 tsunami, issued an appeal for people not to give money.
Wow.
To the victim.
Wow. I mean,
it's almost like a kind of, this is the thing about Ayn Rand. There is something very, very, if you don't take it seriously, there's something very funny about it. Because she's like a kind of supervillain in a kind of comedic, like literally, you try to imagine the worst thing someone could possibly say. And she said, my favorite is, she said everyone should smoke because it was a symbol of man's victory over fire. And when she got lung cancer, she said it was all communist propaganda that smoking caused lung cancer, and then of course she died of it. But there's a kind of madness to it that is fascinating to watch.
And you, in fact, in the end of your article, compare her to L. Ron Hubbard.
Sure, I think I was trying to think of figures in American life that resemble her. You know, this is another crazy, pitiful charlatan who used trashy potboilers to whip up a cult. But the problem is, you know, L. Ron Hubbard's cult is confined to people like Tom Cruise and various, you know, Hollywood dimwits who don't know anything. What's worrying is Ayn Rand's cult goes right to the top of American power. You know, as I say, Alan Greenspan, very close protege of her, put into practice a lot of her philosophy. A large part of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, the unofficial leader of the Republican Party, is telling everyone to read Atlas Shrugged, you know, saying it's a parable for our times. This is a book, as I say, that explicitly contains a terrorist attack on American civilians and says they had it come in because they voted for a president who was in favor of raising taxes. You know, there is something very dark and disturbing on the American right, and it is best epitomized by Ayn Rand. And for that reason and that reason alone, people should read her.
Well, Johan Hari, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Johan Hari is a journalist and writer for The Independent of London, winner of the George Orwell Award, and he was also called Amnesty International's Newspaper Journalist of the Year in 2007. We've been discussing the article that he recently wrote about Ayn Rand on Slate.com. You can also visit his website, johanhari.com, to read all of his articles. That's johanhari.com, or just check our website kpfk.org/uprising after 10 a.m. today, and all of those links will be up. After today's Empire Notes, we'll be joined in studio by Ron Astor, a USC professor of urban social development, asking the right questions after the brutal Richmond High gang rape. Stay tuned. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her recent trip to Pakistan.
I'm beginning to think maybe Condoleezza Rice wasn't such a bad Secretary of State. Those who thought that the Bush administration had a monopoly on uncomprehending sanctimony, meaningless and condescending expressions of concern, and blaming others for one's own faults in foreign relations need only look at what the media has been labeling Hillary Clinton's recent charm offensive. Well, the term is half right. She hectors Pakistanis about the prevalence of poverty and the lack of development. How does a country that consistently ranks in the bottom 20% of rich nations in foreign aid as a percentage of GDP have the face to talk about development? How much more so in Pakistan, whose pattern of massive inequality, feudal social relations, corruption, and autocracy owes so much to consistent reflexive U.S. support for a string of military dictatorships going back almost to the beginning of the Cold War. Even worse, she hectors Pakistanis about their lack of enthusiasm for America's war. In a meeting with newspaper editors, she said, quote, "Al-Qaeda has had safe haven in Pakistan since 2002. I find it hard to believe that nobody in your government knows where they are and couldn't get them if they really wanted to." Remarkably, she made these comments while admitting that she doesn't really know what the situation is. She followed this up while talking to students at Government College University in Lahore by extending the accusation to the entire population of Pakistan. Why exactly a poor peasant in the tribal areas would want to become a foot soldier in her war is apparently not something she considers worth thinking about. Although the English-language Pakistani press at least treated her with restraint, it's hard to imagine too many Pakistanis who didn't feel the insult. After all, the war in Pakistan, which has claimed several thousand lives, is entirely the fallout from America's war in Afghanistan. In 2001, militant groups in Pakistan concentrated their actions on Kashmir, and Islamist parties were as significant in elections as the Green Party in the United States. All of that changed when the U.S. decided first to prosecute the war, and then to let everyone they were pursuing cross the border into Pakistan while they haired off to Iraq. Those who wish to justify this by saying it was Pakistan's policies like support of the Taliban that led to 9/11 are simply cutting the timeline at an arbitrary but convenient point. Draw it further back to U.S. support for the virulent dictatorship of Zia-ul-Haq and its callous support of the Afghan Mujahideen purely for the purpose of bleeding the Soviet Union, with no concern for the effects on Afghanistan and the region, and the point stands. The same American incomprehension that anyone else could have valid concerns shines through most clearly in an exchange with the woman who condemned the CIA drone strikes as extrajudicial executions and then asked whether they did not constitute terrorism just as surely as the car bombings that have taken such a big toll on Pakistan lately. Apparently, Clinton was as well prepared to answer that as Madeleine Albright was to answer Leslie Stahl's question about the deaths of Iraqi children due to the sanctions, and for the same reason. Such things are not allowed to trouble the beautiful minds of the imperial elite when making their imperial dispositions. The pace of drone strikes has considerably increased under Obama. In the past 10 months, there have already been 30% more than last year. According to a recent study by Peter Bergen and Catherine Tiedemann of the New America Foundation, since 2006, drone strikes have killed 750 to 1,000 people, of whom they estimate two-thirds were militants and one-third civilians. An initial tally by Pakistani journalist Amir Mir estimated much higher civilian casualties, but his method seemed to be to assume that anyone who's not a named high-value target was a civilian. Of those deaths, half of them have come in 2009. Had Clinton been better prepared, she would have known the conventional U.S. answer. Civilians killed in drone bombings are collateral damage. The U.S. is attacking valid military targets and they just got in the way. Of course, the same could be said of many of the suicide car bombings carried out by the Tehrik-e-Taliban. The latest Pakistani offensive in South Waziristan has created 250,000 refugees and set off a series of retaliatory bombings in Peshawar, Rawalpindi, Karachi, Lahore, and across the country that have killed over 300 people. Just from the timing of recent suicide bombings, it's clear that they're happening because of Pakistani military offensives. Most of them likely would not happen otherwise. Unlike George Bush, Barack Obama is capable of understanding these things if he wants to. He just seems to perceive little need to do so. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. The parents of the 15-year-old victim allegedly gang-raped outside a high school homecoming dance in Richmond, California, spoke out this past weekend. Pastor Jim Wheeler of the First Presbyterian Church of Richmond read their prepared statement on Saturday that encouraged those enraged by the incident to, quote, work toward changing the atmosphere in our schools and in this community so that this kind of thing never happens again. Seven teenage suspects, including three minors, have been taken into custody in connection with the October 24th gang rape that occurred on the campus of Richmond High School. Local police suspect that as many as 10 assailants were involved in the more than two-hour attack, while a dozen or so others are thought to have witnessed the incident without reporting or intervening. As the gang rape has made national headlines, questions surrounding the state of American youth have inevitably risen. Explanations such as the, quote, bystander effect have been utilized to answer the question as to why no youth attempted to stop the assault for 2 hours. Richmond High School students, in speaking for themselves, noted that the alley where the rape took place was security compromised. School officials reportedly had requested on previous occasions to no avail that lighting and cameras be installed. My guest is Ron Avi Astor. He is a USC professor of urban social development, social work, and education. He recently wrote a commentary on CNN.com called Ask the Right Question About Gang Rape. Welcome to Uprising, Ron.
Thank you for having me here.
So in addition to your analysis about how people are sort of covering this issue, you know the area pretty well. This is your area of expertise as well. What were your thoughts when you first heard about this horrific incident?
Well, first of all, I was shocked and in horror having heard what happened. I think everybody was, and that's appropriate and normal. I think what I was even more taken back was that very few solutions were being talked about on the radio and the TV and the airwaves. The vast majority of the commentary were just focused on understanding the perpetrators better, which I think people should be doing and society should try and understand. But there are a lot of students at Richmond High, and there are many teachers and there are community members who did not participate in this and who condemn it as well. And if given the opportunity to prevent it, I'm sure many of them would step forth and gladfully participate in that. And that wasn't being talked about in the media, all the potential solutions, so that we don't have many more Richmonds in the future.
Now, it wasn't just high school students. It was former students. It's not really known, you know, exactly who all was involved since it took place over such a long time and so many people. And it really wasn't stopped until, I believe, a group of girls, high school students, female students, decided to intervene and call the police.
Yeah, they were bystanders. It's not clear if they were students, but we know that one of them was an 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. She's come forth and talked on many of the channels, and we've seen her. And she's, in my opinion, a very, very important person that society should be looking at. It's not by chance we're condemning an entire group of students at Richmond High, but it was the students who came forth to actually tell the police. And we have to remember that, because that is part of the solution. That's what I wrote about at CNN. You know, some of the questions that we should be asking, in my opinion, have to do is, you know, what opportunities are we giving students to actually be partners in communities that have high crime, to actually help make their schools, their neighborhoods, the routes to and from school secure?
Here in Southern California, we may not be familiar with the Richmond area. It's up in the Bay Area. Describe this area. You're familiar with it?
Yes. I did actually my doctoral PhD internship in Richmond Unified, so I'm familiar with the different areas. I haven't been there in a decade, so it could have changed since I've been there. But it was very high crime. There are certain areas that are heavily gang infested with very serious violent crimes going on in those areas. I could say way back in the 90s even, one of the things that we were tackling with as staff members in the schools was why teachers wouldn't come there in the evenings, why parents wouldn't come to participate. And it became very, very clear that these were dangerous areas. The irony, even back then, was that even though we didn't require teachers to come to certain events at the time or parents, when there were student events, nobody made sure that each of the students had a way to get home or a way to get to the – it was out of our conscious. It was out of the consciousness. And that was one of the things that some of the staff members worked on at the time. It looks like it fell by the wayside here. But it's very obvious here that each student in that school should have had a clear plan on a way to get home, cooperation with their parents. Everybody should have either had a ride or corridors of safety. Things like that you'd expect in a high crime area. Instead, once they left the gym facility, they're just on their own.
Yeah, and in fact, the 15-year-old who is the victim of this incident, she was waiting for her father to give her a ride home, or was on her way to wait for her father to get a ride home. When the assault took place, she was semi-conscious, we understand. She is reportedly going to be okay, at least physically. But I'm also wondering, Ron, if you can comment on the sort of, you know, aside from the crime in the area, aside from the fact that the community and the school had not done enough to provide a safe space for the children, what is it also about the way our society views girls and the way young men are taught to view girls that you think could have played into this?
These are very serious problems in our society. If girls are objectified as sexual objects rather than human beings, and the sanctity that's within them as a human being is not recognized by other males in society, then we do see these kinds of activities happening. And this isn't the first or the last rape, unfortunately, that we're going to have to deal with in our society. Part of it has to do as well with the bystanders, and that is correct, mm-hmm. but not with the perpetrator bystanders who stood away. It's with the rest of the students at Richmond High. And I do believe that our society has not given these students enough power and enough credit to help influence the context that they're in to be safer for girls. Let me give you an example. USC has historically been in a high-crime area. I see now the efforts that students, the teachers, that community members are making to reclaim territories, to reclaim areas. And that's a collective community-organized process that involves professors, that involves the police, that involves the students, that involves the parents. We come together. I'll give you two examples. One is the Kids Walk program sponsored by USC, where they created corridors of safety. We can't deal with the whole city, but let's make sure that kids who go to elementary schools around USC have safe areas to get to and from. That doesn't just involve police officers. That's people sitting on their porches in the morning during certain times. These are grandmas and grandpas. These are students who care about it. These are older students who are keeping their eyes out for. So we know that just having the community out there watching and participating and knowing where to go when there's an issue prevents crimes in these kinds of situations. It makes it safer for girls. I could see also with undergraduates, for example, USC has gone to great extents, 24/7, to make sure that girls have a safe way and young women to get to the library from their dorms to the library. And it's created safer areas. There's no reason in the world why places like Richmond can't be organized by the faculty, staff, and students and empowered to do similar kinds of things.
In fact, let's take a listen to some of the voices of Richmond High School students as well as a youth worker reflecting on the alleged gang rape. And we have to say the word alleged because it's still a case in court. It's going to be in court soon, and arrests are still being made. And this was at a press conference held last week, taped by New America Media.
I feel very disappointed that this had to happen and able for them to listen to us, for us to get cameras, for us to get fans. See, now they're looking at Richmond High as a dangerous place, and it's hurting the students now.
You can see, like, our school's improving. Like, look at our test scores. Look it. We improved. Why, like, I don't understand. Why don't people, like, look at our positive side?
The sad part, it takes such a heinous crime for people to react to something, you know, and yet we're, you know, over 40-plus murders in this community.
I think the media really spiraled an immediate reaction in the students.
So Richmond High is a really, really great school. First of all, I'm not ashamed of Richmond High School.
Honestly, I think if any of us wouldn't have been feeling safe, we wouldn't be here right now. You know, we all come to school every day. This is our community. We love our community.
We had a counseling in the little theater, and our friends, like the guys that came with us, they were like, I feel scared for the girls. I feel like I have to be with my friends at all times.
People are really, they're really upset. I know I'm one of the students. I'm really devastated with the score not, you know, but like I said, you know, things happen, and you know, what we're trying to do, you know, common solidarity.
My thing is, I hope that there's really going to be a commitment, that they're still committed to making change and working on solutions.
Special thanks to New America Media for providing a clip of their coverage of the brutal gang rape, alleged gang rape, that took place last week on the campus of Richmond High School up in the Bay Area. 15-year-old girl was raped. and arrests are still being made. So my guest is Ron Avi Astor, a professor of urban social development, social work, and education at the University of Southern California. He wrote an op-ed on CNN.com called "Ask the Right Question About Gang Rape." Ron, what has the, you know, when we talk about the sort of media coverage of people trying to explain this, whenever there's school violence, you get a lot of sort of questions, how did this happen? And we talked about the bystander effect. First of all, explain the bystander effect and why you think it's too narrow a question to even ask in this situation.
That's a great question. First of all, it's a great academic question to ask in social psychology. So I'm glad social psychologists are doing it and there's room for those kinds of questions. The reason why I think it's too narrow in this situation is because it only focuses on the perpetrators. It only focuses, and I am including in the perpetrator category those boys and men that stood around and watched. They are also perpetrators, in my opinion. And while it's really important for us to understand why they did what they did, when you hear the commentaries, they're talking about all American youth, all youth around the world, all students at Richmond High. What's wrong with our society? Well, in fact, we actually – people don't know it because the media doesn't report it. But the crime rates amongst youth are some of the lowest that they've been since the 1950s, particularly here in Los Angeles. Serious crime rates. There's something going on right with our youth, and nobody really wants to talk about that. So if we're going to talk blanket – the second reason why I think it's too narrow is because it really blocks the solution to the problem that I was talking about earlier. And part of the solution is that the youth themselves are the answer to preventing these kinds of situations. If the school and the police and the youth amongst themselves feel that they can prevent these situations by speaking, by talking, by not being afraid to go to the police, by not being afraid to go to – and they know that they're going to respond appropriately. We know since Columbine and since Virginia Tech that students step forth and they do the right thing. We know that. People have set up hotlines. Once students realized after Columbine that it's not about tattletaling or snitching or that they're actually saving their peers' lives, we have hotlines – across all many of the states in the United States with thousands of students who have reported weapons, potential heinous situations such as this. There was one in Green Bay where the kids were collecting napalm. Mm-hmm. Their parents were helping them buy submachine guns. You know, you don't hear about this in the national media, but it's the students that step forth. Even in the Bay Area, just this semester in Hillsdale High School, you know, a tip to the police and alerting one of the teachers actually saved the life of – we don't know how many kids, but there was a child going down with bombs ready to blow up the school like Columbine. We don't hear about it because people haven't died. But we do need to hear when students step forth and they are here because that will send a message – to the other students that they could do it. They're not passive. They could be active in this situation. And the schools need to expect that too because the students hear about these events or about the potential of these events far, far before anybody else does.
Ron, in thinking about this issue, it also sort of makes me wonder, minors, I mean, people under the age of 18, they're minors. It is the responsibility of parents, yes, of the teachers, of adults, of the adult community to ensure their safety. And how much attention is being placed, you think, to that, you know, to that failure? Because clearly a failure did occur at Richmond.
Yeah, I think you're right on target. This is first and foremost the most important responsibility is for those adults that are in the school to secure the school grounds.
And they didn't install the lights that were needed in the alley.
And they knew it.
After years.
We know that they knew it because they requested it and just never happened. And if you looked at the different coverage and you heard the students speaking here, they all knew about these hotspot places, and so did the district because they requested video cameras and lights for these areas. But again, it's amazing that they knew it, the students knew it. Even at the event, one of the students who's the friend of one of the victims came forth and said, you know, I looked out and I saw a dozen of these guys. We don't know if any of these were the perpetrators. The police and the security guards did nothing. The vice principal looked and did nothing. So these are major failures. If you knew about these places on your high school grounds and the students know about these places and they do know about these places, they'll tell you about them, then it is the school's obligation to patrol these areas, to make sure students don't go there, to make sure that you find lights one way or the other. Or don't hold the event there if you're going to do that. We run through our research projects. We've been doing this since 1999. We actually ask students to map hotspot areas in and around their schools, within their school and just immediately outside their schools. And then we interview students and teachers about it. What's amazing is that, like I said earlier, is the vast majority of students know where these areas and times are. And they tell you beforehand what should be done about it, what the adults and what the other students should be doing to fix it. If we don't listen to the students and we don't use that form of prevention, then we'll end up just focusing on why do we have perpetrators. And while that's really important to eventually find out, we can prevent these kinds of events by securing these grounds, by listening to the students, by bringing them in as partners. And we have evidence of that. We see that maybe thousands, we think, of very serious shootings, happenings that we're afraid even to talk about on school grounds have been prevented because students come forth. That story is not being told.
Hmm. Well, finally, Ron Astor, are there specific places you think on the internet or campuses that could be models? You cited USC itself for people listening who might be involved in a school or, you know, an area that young children are involved to help make their spaces safer for girls and boys.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad that you brought that up as well, too. One of the reasons why I want the media to be focusing on this is because our research in Europe and the Middle East and other places shows that actually when you do find these places, they're not a needle in the haystack. They're all over these wonderful examples of places where people are doing the right thing. The consciousness of the general public and even researchers is minimal in this area because we only focus on the places that have the shootings. But there's places in LA that are doing remarkable jobs. In the commentary itself, I have an example of one of the hotlines in Colorado that has been remarkably successful because they promote it to students and teachers. It's anonymous. They've had thousands of reports after Columbine. And, of course, Columbine was a motivator for people to do that. But that's an example of, for example, a hotline of places. But there are many, many schools out there that are doing the right thing, are securing, have low. It's hard for us to find them because the media is completely focusing on what's negative about these places.
The sensationalist stories, basically.
Yeah. One last issue is there's the California Healthy Kids Survey. And if there was a way for our state, they do collect violence information on every campus. That tends not to get out to the public, and it should be. This way, people would be able to look at their own school districts, at each school within their school district, and see which ones have low rates of violence, even though they're in high crime areas. Mm-hmm. And it would be those places that you want to go and look at to learn from, because if they're controlling it on campus and kids are having a safe experience, I wish we could have thousands of those kinds of examples.
Well, Ron Astor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ron Avi Astor is the professor of urban social development, social work, and education at University of Southern California. We'll link to his article at CNN.com from our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, the feminist Anna Garland Spencer once said, "The earth is ready, the time is ripe for the authoritative expression of the feminine as well as the masculine interpretation of that common social consensus, which is slowly writing justice in the state and fraternity in the social order." That's Anna Garland Spencer. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Steve Pride is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.